This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Against Passeist Venice. We repudiate antique Venice, exhausted and undone by centuries-old voluptuousnesses, which even we once loved and possessed in a grand, nostalgic dream. We repudiate the Venice of outsiders, market of fakers and antiquarians, magnet of snobbery and of universal imbecility, bed unbottomed by caravans of lovers, hip bath bejeweled for cosmopolite courtesans, cloaca maxima of passeism. We want to heal and cicatrize this putrescent city, magnificent sore of the past. We want to reanimate and nobilize the Venetian populace, fallen into decay from its antique greatness, morphinized by a nauseating cowardice and vilified by the habit of its fishy little trades. We want to prepare for the birth of an industrial and military Venice that would dominate the Adriatic Sea, great Italian lake. Let us rush to fill the small, stinking canals with the rubble of the crumbling and leprous old palaces. Let's burn the gondolas, rocking easy chairs for idiots, and erect the imposing geometry of metallic bridges and factories pluming with smoke to the sky to abolish the falling curves of old architectures. Let the rain of divine electric light come to liberate Venice from its venal moonlight of bedrooms for rent. Against Passeist Venice, 1910. When in 1910, F.T. Marinetti and comrades air-bombed crowds arriving from the Lido's new beach resorts with 800,000 copies of the Futurist Manifesto Against Passeist Venice from the clock tower of St. Mark's Square, symbolically hijacking the timekeeping function of the medieval campanile being pathetically reconstructed as it was, where it was, across the plaza, the ushered the burgeoning leisure class into a new accelerated tempo and defined the futurist mission in unprecedentedly concrete terms. The manifesto against Venice dropped in this seminal happening, which launched a decades-long socio-aesthetic campaign and manner of doing art, forms the futurist's first would-be urban plan. It calls on Venetians to destroy the decrepit cities of the curves of the city of lagoons and to erect the imposing geometry of an industrial port in their place, sealing off Venice's signature influx from afar phantasmatically to make of the Adriatic Sea a great Italian lake. Efforts to modernize the city whose slow erosion was darling to foreign romantics and decadent aesthetes had been debated locally for two decades, and from 1917 forward, capitalist impresarios were to develop the port of Marghera as the lung of Venetian modernity. Yet the performative force of the futurist tractates does more to drive Venice into the rhetoric and epos of the modern than any piecemeal effort of modernization. The Nuova Venezia, wrought imaginatively by the futurist polemic, struck such a resounding chord that today's Venetians view the port and petrochemical plants as Marinetti's dream realized. Launched on the heels of Daniel Burnham's 1909 plan of Chicago, the futurist scheme to cicatrize Venice ushers the 19th century urban ideal of Haussmann's Paris being implemented internationally into a cityscape particularly unaccommodating to such blueprints, as well as to later fascist campaigns of sventramento, or urban disembowelment, in the service of an aesthetic program of romanity. Venice is an archipelago that sits in a lagoon, dissociated from the mainland of northern Italy and protected from the Adriatic Sea by a series of barrier islands. It was founded upon quagmires and planted upon such unfirm, Moorish, and spongy foundations out of necessity, as a Venetian historian of the 16th century puts it. Popular tradition has it that the islands were settled by Romans fleeing the invading Huns and were built up through centuries of collaboration with environmental flux, every day altering and changing according to the tides of the sea. Human intervention modified the wetlands' ecological balance over time while maintaining a delicate equilibrium. Identified in the plural on early maps, what we call Venice was once a loose configuration of island cells, or insule, rendered singular by the consolidation of marshes between the end of the first millennium and the 14th century. In 1560, Francesco Sansovino described the transition between city zones as a continual process of adaptation and estrangement. Quote, Venice shows itself not to be only one, but many cities, separated and all conjoined at once in such a manner that exiting one quarter and entering another, you will say without a doubt that you are exiting one city and entering another, with the infinite ease of the inhabitants and the stupefaction of foreigners, unquote. In the discontinuous texture of superimposed canals and calli, or alleyways for pedestrians, we still encounter seams between the original island parishes that were never aligned by rational planning once reclamation filled in the liquid divisions. Though the archipelago was connected to the mainland by rail in the mid-19th century, which you should be able to see here, it's a straight line going to the mainland, and by an automobile bridge in the 1930s, the paradoxical harmony among discordant nuclei still conditions any motion through the Venice of today. The discordant harmony of Venice has inspired countless eulogies and polemics, the past century and a half of which Killing the Moonlight attempts to track. Why train one's attention on the last 150 years of intellectual and aesthetic engagement with Venice when, due to the extraordinary geographical constraints, few subsequent interventions have altered its structure and pace, while the forms of most cities, even medieval ones like Paris and Barcelona, have changed utterly? Why pause in a reputedly decadent backwater when, as commonplace has it, Venice had constituted no center of new artistic production since the fall of the Venetian Republic to Napoleon in 1797? These were questions often and actually put to me when I first set out upon this research project, just following the bicentennial anniversary of the Venetian Republic's fall. The initial answer is straightforward, though its exegesis can become rather convoluted. Venice compels attention precisely because the city rebukes the injunctions of the new that govern both modern cities and art, as this non-compliance drives artists and theorists through unruly byways in cognition and the construction of form. Insofar as modernity is defined by the myth of a radical break with the past, Venice persists as an exemplary aberration. Not only does it prove unaccommodating to any unfettered destruction of historical form or imposition of the new, but it operates according to material constraints rather than the classical figures and geometries privileged by the selective memory nostalgia of modernist artists and planners. While the medieval mazes of Paris, London, or Dublin are historically contingent, Venice's very foundations are labyrinthine. Italo Calvino calls Venice the first anti-Euclidean city. Once the heart of the city was consolidated as a fish-shaped complex around the beginning of the 14th century, all further development was conditioned by the need to reutilize the existing foundations, which had been laid out at great cost with wood, bricks, and stone imported by river, lagoon, and sea. Lagoon inhabitants were obliged into adaptive reuse, both of these foundations and of existing architraves, capitals, cornices, and columns fabricated in different places and periods, so that even when buildings were renovated during the Renaissance and beyond, they retained a certain Byzantine shape or an odd eclecticism of languages and styles. The urban fabric is thus inherently anachronistic and polycultural. And though I won't give any examples right now, I throughout the book talk about how writers and artists are obliged into adaptive reuse of the pieces of Venice and of the signatures that have been inscribed into the city. Being hybrid in its foundations, decentralized, and bound to a reciprocal relationship with natural and cultural influx, Venice balks at the design ideals of classical and Renaissance Rome, ideals revivified to global consequence in the planning of Hausmann's Paris of the Second Empire and in the only partially realized Vie Imperiali of fascism. It thus forces us to reconceive of the relationship between the city of the long 20th century and its would-be flaneurs. As a fissured, labyrinthine, amphibious complex, Venice presents unique aesthetic, intellectual, and socio-political opportunities, and above all, constraints. So I'm just going to quicksilverly show you some images that will bring out how the unbuilt Venice of modernism has activated the imagination of the 20th century. This is Le Corbusier's unbuilt project for the hospital at San Giobbe, which encapsulated several decades of his fascination with Venice. It conceived of the hospital as part of the city fabric, incorporating the calli, or alleys, and campielli, or little squares of Venice, into the plan. And he imagined being able to see through the white stone of the complex into the city. It fell by the wayside, being judged alien to its context. Note the contrast between curvaceous Venice and the Mondrian-like modernist grid. But Peter Eisenman was later to reconstruct it as if it had been built. So here he places in his own model for a quite postmodern conceptual plaza in Venice, he imposes Le Corbusier's modernist hospital into the city. And I talked with some architects about this, and they said, but you don't understand, it is there, you know. And the Spanish artist Dionisio Gonzalez to bring out the contrast between Le Corbusier's strong vision of healing and the weak conformist architecture that actually does get built in the city because it has a surface, proximity stylistically to what's already there. My study is interested in these projections and shows how any engagement with Venice must contend with a long literary tradition invoking Venice as a metaphor for glory or decay. As Venice, Venus, the feminized instrument of the Serenissima's native political agendas, or Venice whore, the splendid corrupt matrix of foreign sexual political fantasies, vinegia d'ogni bruttura ricevitrice, in Boccaccio's words, Venice receptrix of all foulnesses. From Machiavelli to Otway to Daphne du Maurier and Ian McEwan, I aim to move beyond instrumental use of the city as symbol or as backdrop, instead treating the urban complex as active ambience, as actuality. This is a difficult task in reckoning with any city, but I try to show it is particularly challenging in a site so encrusted with centuries of narcissistic signatures. In contouring the city's waxing material against myriad modern subjective designs, my book is less a study of Venetian modernism than of modernism in Venice. The subtitle echoes Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, but displaces death with modernism. It also suggests that modernism did not really gain a foothold in Venice, despite manifold attempts. Instead, deflected modernist impulses became part of the assemblage, like so much else in Venice. Venice permits us to explore the aspirations, critiques, repressions, and failures of both modernity as development and ideology, and modernism as aesthetic response. When the ecological damage inflicted by Port Marghera and other modernizing campaigns begins to show through the apocalyptic flooding in the post-war period, this is the famous flood of 1966 that sent international alarms going. the city of and modern notions of progress in turn become obsolete, the city of lagoons being as perennially open to industrial contaminants as it has been to organic influx, can be seen to host a discomfiting marriage of its famed stones with the detritus of modernizing campaigns. In a 1976 essay provocatively titled Venice, Perhaps, the poet Andrea Zanzotto, a Veneto native, overturns centuries of romanticization by bringing its coagulation of primordial beauty and post-industrial sludge to the fore. In Zanzotto's post-utopian handling, this corner of the Adriatic reveals its status as a poor well clotted with sewage, quote, where the purest mother of pearl fuses with the equivocal iridium of industrial dejecta, unquote. While rendering the costs of modernization trenchantly clear, the lagoon's contents also literalize the challenge of reconciling this fabled cityscape with an incommensurable ambient temporality, or of framing certain fundamental exigencies of today's rhythms and production with something that is too far past to be conserved or too far in the future to be reinvented. Whether lodged conceptually in the distant past or the distant future, the city of Venice has stood since the dawn of modernity as an anachronism in the cultural imagination. The pre-modern complex resists any uniform present tense and, in turn, any 20th century attempt to mold it into a more rational urban whole. Though the futurists launched their call to kill the moonlight of romantic Venice as early as 1909, the swarms of tourists who still crowd the alleys that link the railway station to St. Mark's Square every summer, seeking the moonlit locus of popular imagery, literature, and song from Antonio Lamberti's 1788 La Biondina in Gondoletta to Madonna's 1984 Like a Virgin, continue to demand that Venice remain an untouched refuge of the past, frozen in time. And I'm really interested in Madonna, in the fact that Madonna chose Venice as the backdrop for a video that is about being touched for the very first time, because Venice is never touched for the very first time by these artists. These desires, though opposing, are equally phantasmatic. Killing the Moonlight accounts for this unrelenting conflict by recomposing a chronically split object of scrutiny that lacks presence in modernist studies in anything but fractured form. It explores the paradoxical project of Venetian modernity on the one hand, and of modernism in Venice on the other, or the socio-aesthetic struggle accompanying these transformations, whether in support of or against them. This is a still from Visconti's Morte a Venezia, his adaptation of the Mann novella, and I'm interested in the fact that this is the opening sequence and that we see very clearly the black steam of the steamship that brings Aschenbach, stream of ashes, into the cityscape. So he's actually doing this adaptation just after the flood. So there's a new kind of ecological and realist awareness infusing Mann's allegory. Being both hostile to the designs of modern urbanism and incompletely obsolete, Venice is a radically anachronistic city, not in the simple sense of the word, though that would suit the tourist's nostalgia, but in the sense that its urban fabric retains remnants of incommensurable historical epochs. As such, the city aggravates 20th century schemes to isolate the present and future from their precedents while continuing to elude any narrative of history that would settle the meaning of the city's past or determine the trajectory of its future. In Venetian incarnations of modernism, residual traces of culture and nature that have allegedly been overcome resurface unpredictably, forcing authors of the progressing future into digressive advances as they struggle ardently to mourn, dismiss, or assimilate what is being left behind. So this is a map of all of the bombs that were dropped by Austro-German airplanes in Venice during World War I, just as a reminder that while Venice appears to hover as an elsewhere just beyond the landscape of modernity, it has never been entirely removed from international political and aesthetic trends and economies, but rather reflects, shadows, and derails them. Still, the historic city of lagoons has represented a rebuke to modernity since the dawn of enlightenment. It has become this point of obsession for those seeking to delineate and explore the conceptual borders of modernism, both early and late. It was in relation to the 1980 Venice Biennial, the world's first freestanding international architecture exhibition, credited with introducing postmodernism to a broad non-specialist artist for the first audience for the first time, that Jürgen Habermas was compelled to define and defend the rationalism of aesthetic modernity. Anachronistic Venice formed an apt environment for an exhibition that represented the sacrifice of the modern tradition, as Habermas would lament. Titled The Presence of the Past and installed in the historic arsenal, which was remodeled and opened dramatically to the public for the first time in its 800-year history, the architectural biennial curated by Paolo Portoghesi emblematized the dawning of a movement that would rummage through the spectral forms of history. Its central exhibit featured a strada novissima, or newest street, of 20 facade fantasies constructed to scale in wood, paper mache, and plaster, with leading architects from Venturi Rausch and Scott Brown to Hans Holein, offering wildly synchronic pastiches of historical shapes and styles. The faux facades were fabricated by the studios of Cinecittà, the cinema complex of Rome. Their disparately styled and mock-spoliated columns, masonry types, and entrance thresholds realized the wistful reawakening of the street as a rebuke to the heroic modernist enterprise, generating heated debate across Europe and the Atlantic. And Hans Holein's facade in the middle here became particularly known. He had one column represents Loos's project for the Chicago Herald Tribune. Mm-hmm. The tree represents the environmental crisis. He's got an unfinished column and puts them all together into one facade. Habermas opened his seminal acceptance speech for the Adorno Prize with a poignant suspicion of this avant-garde of reversed fronts that, quote, sacrificed the tradition of modernity in order to make room for a new historicism, unquote. On this occasion, Habermas famously set himself against the Frankfurt School's critique of enlightenment, whose writings against rationalist, triumphalist historicism clarify the renewed pull of Venice on a post-war generation of intellectuals. Against the new historicism on display in Venice, Habermas identified in the modern impulse, quote, the longing for an undefiled, immaculate, and stable present, unquote. It was not by chance that both Marinetti in 1910 at the dawn of modernism and Habermas in 1980 at the dawn of postmodernism were drawn to define the modern through and against Venice. Despite the wistful visions of modernization of the futurists and their belated inheritors, here this image comes just days before the historic flood of 1966. Modernism had always been subject to stress in a city that offers, in the words of architectural historian and theorist Manfredo Tafuri, a subtle challenge that affects the very presuppositions of modernity. Any quest to usher the city of lagoons into a purely present tense, or even to harmonize its histories, is frustrated by the mediation of centuries of inscription on the one hand, and on the other by structural features of the cityscape itself, a topographical ambiguity or amphibiousness that retains natural features associated with the primordial, and an architectonic obliquity and digression that thwart any Cartesian viewpoint or projection onto the whole. Marinetti's ruthless 19 scheme and its various reprisals over the course of his career reflected a pervasive frustration with Venice, its resistance to what the futurists called sintesi, or synthesis, visible, spatial, and social. Jacopo de Barbari had fashioned a monumental panorama of the archipelago as early as 1500, gathering the work of many surveyors to manufacture a composite bird's eye view, and this is that very famous image. Yet to those unpossessed of such an aid, the labyrinth deflects synthesizing gazes, continuing to bend at odds against the modern French ideal of a direct legibility of space and masses. Marinetti yokes its spatial obscurity anxiously to bodily channels in disprising the city who, like a Procurus wearing a heavy mantle of mosaics, insists on offering us veiled women at every crepuscular turn of her canals. Though Marinetti may be the most bombastic of enemies to, quote, all the diseased literature and endless romantic fantastication draped over the city by poets poisoned with the Venetian fever, unquote, John Ruskin was the first and most vehement to refute the romantic legacy of Venice and to produce nonlinear histories in the process. He admits in The Stones of Venice that it can be tempting to disavow the depredations of modern Venice. The construction of a railway bridge in 1846 made the fabled transition from land to lagoon barely perceptible, so that, quote, the noble landscape of approach to her can now be seen only by a glance as the engine slackens its rushing on the iron line, unquote. Ruskin argues implicitly that we too must approach the city through new channels, like it or not. Many a hurried traveler will be inclined to disguise what is discordant in this scene, but he grants no permission to such obfuscations. He writes, "Impotent feelings of romance may indeed gild, but never save the remains of those mightier ages, and they must be torn away from the magnificent fragments if we would see them. The Venice of modern fiction and drama is a thing of yesterday, a stage dream which the first daylight must dissipate into dust. If we are to discern anything at all in Venice, we must emancipate the city in fragments from the lugubriously sentimental stage dream of romanticism. True engagement obliges us to view magnificent Venice as a complex of objects, however damaged, in the brutal light of the present. Only then can these objects become touchstones of a world that would counter our own." In inventing the avant-garde half a century later, Marinetti echoes Ruskin's call for the merciless illumination of Venice, calling upon citizens to kill the moonlight that pervades popular representations, though he appends that imperative to fill the canals with the ruins of the leprous old palaces. Let the rain of divine electric light come to liberate Venice from its venal moonlight of bedrooms for rent. The careers of these demagogic figures could not seem more opposed to one another. In fact, Ruskin lamented the city's introduction of gaslight in 1845, quote, which Venice provides for your seeing her shop wares by night against your seeing the moon, unquote. While Marinetti blamed Ruskin for having, quote, singularly developed the obsessive cult of our past in Europe, unquote. However dissimilar, these authors pursue a common end which appropriates the rhetoric of enlightenment and becomes central to the scheme of modernism. By striking Venice with the light of day and electricity, respectively, they seek to collapse romantic distance from the place, to regard the city as material, however distressed, in the present tense. Their aspiration toward objectivity aims to restore to the discordant material at hand a radiant presence, even if their hopes and methods for arriving at presence are diametrically opposed. the aspiration to revive Venice by subjecting romantic falsehoods to the light of the current day has yielded a century and a half of aesthetic experimentation whose struggle deserves its own chapter in the history of modernism. Venice becomes the locus par excellence in which to contend with traces of the past that foil the quest for presence Habermas locates at the heart of modernism, and ultimately to recover a vitally non-linear form of historicity, wherein the pressure to recuperate the past for present purposes gives rise to countless filtrations and detours. Calvino says in 1968, "I believe in the future of aquatic cities in a world populated by innumerable Venices." Venice does not expire over the centuries of its surface abjection, nor over the decades separating futurism's founding and termination. It persists as a site of influx and efflux that remains steadfastly Venetian, forcing incursions into it to change their ways or channels, literally. This is from the closing sequence of Fellini's Casanova. As such, it resists the dyads of future and past implicit in what Adorno called the fatally rectilinear succession of victory and defeat, forcing authors to contend with the waste products and blind spots that have escaped the dialectic in a vengeful obsolescence. As a republic and since, Venice has remained the site of a distinct cosmic extraterritoriality, as Andrea Zanzotto puts it, punning on its geographical position remote from terra firma. It remains vulnerable to transnational currents. The antique cosmopolis amalgamates waves of local, national, and international claims, giving rise to a mobile species of shadow modernism that no single regime or body politic manages to appropriate or oversee, and obliging us to redraft the confines of the modern in both temporal and geographical terms. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, that was wonderful. And as you can see, there's a lot in this book, and I'd like to ask about one particular passage. But before, if I can extrapolate from what you were just saying, I was wondering whether we couldn't say that in that struggle between the avant-garde and Venice, Venice was victorious and killed the avant-garde. But if this is so, it might be, and this is perhaps what your book is trying to show, that it forces us to redefine modernism. And this is why I was thinking of one very interesting moment in your book in which you describe D'Annunzio writing Notturno, mm-hmm. in Venice, a magnificent text, by the way, and Pound, yes. in Paris, tempted to come to a sort of pre-fascist or already fascist Italy, mm-hmm. but not going to Venice. He went to Rapallo, which was a strange avoidance. You know, the Genoans, yes. who own Rapallo, and the Venetians generally hate each other. But then Pound ended up swallowed again by Venice at the end of his life. Would you agree with this called agonistic modernism that can somehow gnaw at the illusions of the avant-garde, whether they are mm-hmm. on the right or on the left, in a sense?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, and I love your articulation of it, that it can gnaw at the avant-garde. I think that the whole vision of an avant-garde, that sort of militaristic all or nothing, you know, raise it to the ground, that Venice just, it absorbs everything. So, okay, you want that? Okay, you know, I mean, I won't let you raise the city to the ground, but we will incorporate your manifesto into our history. It'll be on the wall of the Guggenheim 100 years from now. I mean, it's had so many projections onto it, and yet it's so set, the sort of city sets so many constraints on what is actually able to be done, that it remains its own thing. And so the projections of the avant-garde become much more legible, actually. And the incursions of modernization become more legible. I mean, it's much more striking if you see how many PCBs are in the Grand Canal and you're looking at the gorgeous palaces on the other side of the Grand Canal than it is to see those figures in front of the Gowanus Canal, you know? It's like, oh, they made it here too, you know? I mean, we came here to get away from all that, but there's water and it infiltrates everything. So I'm just fascinated in this kind of absorptive quality of Venice, and Zanzotto talks about it as a sort of, that it has the capacity to absorb the leaden actuality of the present, and he's writing that in the so-called Years of Lead in Italy, so he's making a pun on that, but there's something about the floating city that it doesn't let the lead sink it, you know. So yes, it really forces us to reconceive of what we mean by the avant-garde and this kind of agonistic, dialectical, you know, model that we have for thinking about the old and the new. Instead, it's much more about assemblage, about absorption, accretion, and everything's just a lot harder at first to see, but then when you do see it, it's very striking.
In the idea of Marinetti's utopia, one element that he rejects is the museum. Anything that looks like a museum is bad. And of course, Venice was already, at that time, its own museum. But this is not so rare. My city, Paris, is also its own museum. Mm-hmm. Rome is also its own museum. Not so Chicago, but perhaps soon. To me, Chicago, as soon as that's you have tourism as something that is official and that brings revenue to a place, it becomes a certain museum.
Well, Manhattan, of course. It's become more and more.
Yeah, Manhattan, exactly. Yeah.
But right, so we like to think that Manhattan and Paris are
the Gowanus area as the new Venice, where I live, along the Gowanus Canal with the Whole Foods over the Gowanus,
right.
Is a kind of new Venice that's emerging.
Right. Venice was already a tourist destination at the turn of the 20th century. Exactly. They saw that, we can put bathhouses here and the new health will, you know, people will come to Venice for health reasons, and that's what Man is really milking, that there's the idea of going to the beach for health, but actually it's a malarial swamp. Mm-hmm. And playing with those contradictions, let's say. But I don't have a simple answer for the Disneyfication or museumification of Venice. I mean, it's actually very disturbing, of course. But I'm interested in the fact that Venice made its own these international phenomena such as the World Exhibition, that they were the first to have the Biennale of Art, they were the first to invent an international film festival, and then the first to host a freestanding international architectural exhibition. So while other cities were having exhibitions to industrial progress, Venice went the aesthetic route and said, oh, well, we're going to have country pavilions, but they'll show off the best of their art. And this was a way of retaining a certain dialogue and a certain liveliness in the city that still persists today. And it's why it's possible for me to write a book like this, because so many contemporary artists and writers have come to Venice to see, you know, what people are making of this cliched complex.
Well, you're going to read your poem, right?
Well, I brought this poem that I wrote in response to basically a kind of commission by Melissa Ragona and John Carson at Carnegie Mellon. We put together a portfolio of prints, and perhaps it's, yeah, we put together a portfolio of prints. So I made this, it looks a little bit like that in reality, but this was a mock-up that I was able to put into the PowerPoint. And this is not an answer to anything. The only thing that it might accomplish for me to read this is to show that what I learned about the city kind of leaks into everything else that I do, and that I have a million thoughts about it that can't be resolved in the sort of university press format, let's say. So this was called Non-Euclidean Recall, and it might be just helpful to see the image. As the reciprocal interference between hues of an enchanted field and the oils of the city of lagoons, a strain of vulnerability in common, non-proprietary, despite. Venice, age-old haunt of social affections ever veering on capitulation to framed anxieties and lures, on reflection as soundless echo from port to virtual port. At the once military arsenal after the fall, installed ellipses recall in noise the free-weaving melodies swelling through Ottaviano Petrucci's press, motet from movere mot, polyphony at the cusp of the Renaissance, chancing still to be multiplied as it reaches untold eyes, voices. Eloquio across distance, the city as trust interface, all exposure, call and reply scored, and tremulousness brave. Recollecting the rapport, not contest, between colloquy, sustenance, commotion. Underbelly of enlightenment, what happens to senses and sentences and sense when perception has no warning against the gorgeousness of bending corners, twists, tiepolin, a feasting on the fact that the sought-after object of a gaze, ever an ambivalent target of veneration, can itself deflect, wield puissance. Guest stanza of a half-private Venetian home, nested memory of a pre-dawn apparition of a girl turning toward a garden, ineluctably pixelated here, wound of color, abstract as the square, tilting away from pale folios of softening time. And a woman converted to colorism out of this place returns as if in dream to the linear abstraction of an ideal maturity left orphan, still against the Adriatic. Bounding out of the lost triteness of the city's disuse, out of hallucinated futurist killings of the moon, off-season, marsh lightness unroutable by wire or wirelessness. Its light itself, see everywhere inside, shuttered theory.
Hmm. One of the things that interests me about this presentation versus reading the book is how different it is to see you have this set of images, and it's much more image-based than the book is. The book is actually a lot more literary, with the Calvino and the Pound and what the fascist issues and the stuff around Marinetti dominate the experience, to me, of reading it, partly because I probably read those passages more closely than some of the stuff about the architecture and so on when I read the manuscript, because I was particularly fascinated by that. And yet, at the same time, this is why I was interested that you would read a poem, too. I'm thinking of the variation of your work as a kind of either montage or collage, and that under the frame of this cloth-bound book seems to be some kind of literary monograph about modernism and Venice and what you all that stuff that you said. But the experience of looking at it was a very aestheticized experience. After all, I particularly, I don't want to go into this, had an enormous number of associations that had nothing to do with what you were talking about, but about Venice when I was looking at it and the way in which Venice is so haunting, and haunted for me, of course. But, I mean, that's one of the qualities of many of the historical relations of Venice, how its conception of, there's even a name for that kind of Venice fever, right? People would faint in the 19th century when they would first see Venice. What is that? Isn't there a name for that? There was a name
like
for this.
Like the Venetian mode of Stendhal syndrome.
Yeah, Stendhal syndrome. That. Mm-hmm. So you'd see it and you'd be so overwhelmed by the glassiness of the water. But in a way, you have created an aesthetic Stendhal syndrome in the guise of this scholarly book. You've actually created what seems to be a montage or a collage with a set of images that we bounce off of. In this context, now I have a very specific institutional relationship with you, very supportive of your getting tenure at the University of Chicago, for example, and coming there and so on, and of your work as a poet and so on, and your work as a translator. So one of the things I wanted to do, rather than be overwhelmed by this stuff about Venice, is to refocus on you and your work as a scholar, because even I had planned to say this, was kind of, didn't know if I would want to come back to that, because there's so much I was thinking about in respect to Venice and the Pound stuff and so on. But you've done that with this. So I'm interested in a remark, a Lacanian slip that Professor Rabatet made when he described you as a professor of Romance languages and creative writing, of which, as far as I know, you're neither. You're a professor of English at the University of Chicago.
Well, no, I'm all.
You may be an associate professor associated with Romance languages.
Yeah.
Were you not hired by the English department?
No, I was hired by the English department.
Thank you.
And you creative are writing tenured is within like the English department. Department.
I'm making this point for reasons that for polemical reasons. I almost don't have to say more. But I'm interested in even Jean-Michel, who also, by the way, my other favorite example with you, is a professor primarily of, what is it, English. Also a professor of English. And this, to me, suggests a welcome transformation, but not an easy one for you, probably not as difficult for Jean-Michel in a certain way, given his work with Joyce and Pound, but for you, quite interesting, and certainly one that there was conflict with the Literary Academy. So, maybe you could address this. So there are two issues here, one of which is the subject matter. In the introduction to the book, you say at a certain point, maybe it was T.J. Clark that said to you, where indeed we first met, in Berkeley, where you work with Altieri, of course, distinguished professor, mostly known for his work on modernist American poetry and contemporary American poetry, he said, well, maybe your subject, what your subject is Pound, your English is Pound, modernism, Italian, American poetry, if Pound is indeed American. I believe now that he's a Venetian poet. you decided your subject was Venice, but how can Venice be a subject?
Right.
And how can Venice be a subject for somebody who's part of an English department? And how can a book which is essentially a montage, possibly a collage of associations which you project out, be a monograph within that context?
Oh my goodness, how can it? You know, you're reminding me of this horrible moment when I was a doctoral student and I gave my cover letter to one of the assistant faculty members, and he didn't get tenure, but, you know, so I, he said, well, my first question is, you're applying to this job, but your book is on Venice.
Ah, well, all right, so I'm really repeating this question.
I was infuriated, you know. I was like, well, where do I even start? This is such a, you know, so there's sort of the straight answer, which is just for various reasons that I try to outline in the book, the English and consequently by association, the Americans have had a love affair with Venice. And once one writer has a love affair with Venice, then all of the writers reading also have that love affair with their predecessor, but it's a homosocial relationship that is triangulated by Venice, the feminine city. So I'm really fascinated in those Oedipal literary relationships and how Venice is the feminine matrix that makes those possible. And this is quite literally played out in Henry James's The Aspern Papers, in which the editor of who's the protagonist of The Aspern Papers really wants to get with Jeffrey Aspern, this American Byron, but he has to do so through Venice and through the papers, you know. And so it's a way that it becomes this kind of place where you get to commune with all of the greats, including Shakespeare, you know. So it was that other site of the Moor and of the Jew. And, you know, that in Shakespeare's time, there was a brothel just named Venice in London. So it had all those associations with the famous courtesans. But I guess that this project and every project that I seem to get my hands on just underscores the absurdity of the idea of a national literature being the governing formation for an intellectual discourse. And I do understand why they're there, but every time I, you know, kind of put hand to paper, if I even do that anymore, I'm just trying to introduce these kinds of currents. I mean, we're not living in a world of national literatures now. There isn't even the support structure for it. I mean, the support structure for literature, if we think of the web, is a transnational structure. So Venice kind of makes that really dramatically clear, because it's a place of tourism and of pilgrimages, and where you can't talk about it just being an Italian literary tradition. But I became very interested in the fact that the Italians have their own designs on Venice and their fascist designs, and what happens to those, and how those fascist designs might be different from the fascist designs that come out of Rome, and how D'Annunzio, as a kind of anarchic bohemian modernist, you know, people don't read D'Annunzio anymore, but he's fantastically interesting and very, very problematic. Wow. But you know, D'Annunzian modernism, this was one of the people that led Ezra Pound to Italy. He was the precursor to Mussolini. The idea that a decadent poet could, like, overtake a country and be, you know, a kind of new emperor on the Adriatic was very exciting for some people at the time. So just thinking about all the different nationalist projections onto Venice became very interesting for me. And then in terms of the composition of the book, I was very interested in montage as a tactic of making an academic book, and I guess some people got it, and that's good, because I wasn't willing to really eliminate that. And so my editors at Columbia recognized that I was trying to redefine modernism as a polytemporal and polycultural phenomenon, and that it is not a linear phenomenon in any way. I mean, when you have the reigning aesthetic being montage, and you have a work like the Cantos, which is polylingual, polycultural, polytemporal, palimpsestic, you need to place that against a different kind of city in order to understand what this figure was getting out of the urban environs that he was visiting. Yeah, what can I say? It's not a very good idea as a poet to try to write an academic book, because you care too much about every sentence, and you're told to front load information, and that's not, you know, my thing.
I feel that on the contrary, it's a good idea, because we need to come to the level of your style, which is quite amazing. Right.
Well, I'm of course interested academic in my book. Yeah, in my questions, I'm interested in focusing just on that issue of what an academic book is, if indeed that's what this is, and putting forward, as John Michel has said, the approach that you're taking within an English department, just to be not comic about the way I'm saying that, but I think that's clear. Now, Paul St. Amour is here, was the editor who, I guess, with his co-editor, selected the book. So from different kinds of angles, there's that interest. And of course, the Henry James part would be another one. You read the book within a kind of Anglo-American modernist aspect. The James is also crucial and fits in. Although the James sort of blurs with the Death in Venice, with the Calvino, so you're putting him within a context that's more resonant to the way that you see him and the way he saw himself. Again, was James as American in what sense? Mm-hmm. I mean, he certainly... also as much Italian as I am a Brooklyn writer now. Being there all, like 14 months in Brooklyn, I'm taking that off. I'm going to write the great utopian epic of the Gowanus. We're going to create our own Gowanus state, but that is for another time. The collage technique or the montage technique that allows for a non-rationalistic connection between elements relates to Habermas's very important part of your talk today had to do with Habermas's regression to a kind of rationalist Enlightenment thinking from what his much more radical, to me, earlier work, which was about a critique of rationality. He couldn't really quite go there himself at this point. This almost, the Las Vegas aspects of that show so repulsed him, and for good reason, but mm-hmm. but he turned away from a certain possibility of reason outside of rationality. So I'm interested in the concept of an evolution of the poet-critic. So here this is a term that's used for Perlman, for Duplessis, for me, for just people immediately here. Wouldn't necessarily think of you as a poet-critic in that sense. You're a poet, you do visual work, and you're doing this work. This work is slightly different than the way we imagine, but I'm thinking of it as being a renewal and an extension of what that could mean along the Susan Howe line in terms of using montage and historical, especially her new book from New Directions, which deals with Jonathan Edwards and the thread and mm-hmm. the material thread, reminds me a lot of what you're doing here. So I wonder how you might think about that issue of methodology. I mean, of course, she's great, and your work is wonderful. And I'm not simply saying you're great like Susan Howe, which I think you are, but that doesn't interest me as much as the question of the method that you're employing.
I guess that I don't know if I can answer that directly, but I became aware at a certain point that I was sort of formulating a poetics below this, deeply below the, you know, surface argument of the text, and it has to do with sentimentality, it has to do with sort of decoration, and all of the things that are still supposed to be off limits for my generation or for anyone making art now, and my own ambivalence towards lyricism, towards decoration, towards femininity, and why I need to feel that way. And yet my fascination in history, which just comes out of my having done archaeology in Sicily as a 19-year-old and unearthed a head of Persephone from a Greek garbage dump. And it was like, that was the end. For the rest of my life, I'll just be like playing with that moment and just reanimating that shock. So I really do believe, I mean, I know we all know about this now, but just I believe in that kind of tiger's leap into the past, and that there are forms that are out of time that can sort of shock us into an awareness of our current circumstance that can just shift perception for a moment. And I was trying to work out what my relationship to history and contemporaneity is as a writer, and whether it is possible to recover any of the decor that I actually love for of some writers like Christina Rossetti, or, you know, I mean, a number of writers. Even I love the heights of Ruskin's rhetoric, and yet he's the most unfashionable person to like. But I mean, did you see the contours of those columns in Space? It is so wild what he was doing. He was just looking at forms in space, and it's sort of radical epistemology. So I was working that out, and it took like 15 years to write this as a narrative, and all the while I was also making poems that, and also working on the translation of a poet who was very interested in the metaphysicals and in Shakespeare and playing with anachronism of diction in her work. And so Venice doesn't really come up as a topic very much in my poetry, but it was more the methodology, placing time signatures against one another in rapid succession and playing with various ways of creating entropic lines of verse where you could kind of see like history and the news brushing up against one another in an uncomfortable and maybe, I don't know, sometimes ecstatic way.
Fantastic. I think we can open to public if you have questions. Yes?
Yeah, at the beginning you started out with against passéisme. I'm not familiar with that word. What does that mean? And is your book an advocacy for modernism against
or historic?
I'm not sure what your book is.
Postulating a position? I mean, you talk about a non-Euclidean city of, is that a good thing according to Calvino or not? are you promoting? Are you advocating for something in terms of Venice with all its pollution, all the tons and tons of pollution? Now, of course, PCBs doesn't hurt you unless it's at a high temperature, and lead doesn't hurt you unless it's put into a powder. But all the other chemicals, if they're ingested, is everybody in Venice in poor health? But your book
I
is
think
not
they're
a
not any in poorer health than the inhabitants around the Gowanus Canal, who are probably paying just as high a rent. I think that, well, passéism is, this was a word, I mean, I think it was coined by the futurists. I mean, it didn't exist before that. Contro Venezia Passatista was the name of a futurist manifesto against Venice. It's not my own. Okay, that was my translation of Marinetti's very amusing, all of the translations in the book are my own. That was a very significant part of the work that kind of isn't foregrounded.
It's a French term. It's a common French term. It was used in the 19th century, passéiste, Marinetti.
So Marinetti was using
French,
that.
I think.
Okay, so he kind of made a word that wasn't really in use Italian. In Italian because he grew up, he went to a French school in Alexandria. He was a very cosmopolitan writer. As to whether it's good or bad, whether I'm for modernism or against, I guess that's what I'm saying about, this is this thing about Venice killing the avant-garde, you know, that it doesn't kind of submit to these contests. So I'm interested in all the contradictions of modernism that Venice makes clear. Now, I might be an advocate for some projects. I think that it would have been great had they actually built Le Corbusier's hospital in Venice. I think it's a great tragedy that they didn't build Louis Kahn's conference
That's
complex.
That's in Philadelphia here. It's the home of Louis Kahn.
Right. So he had designed this amazing conference hall for the Giardini in Venice. And the third most famous example of a building that Venice didn't build because we don't really know was Frank Lloyd Wright's palace on the Grand Canal.
But we should get the University of Pennsylvania to build that Louis Kahn building instead of the building in front of the English department. They could have reconstructed that whole thing. What a great.
Is Venice doing any historic adaptation?
We have other questions here.
We can talk afterwards.
Yeah, we can talk. Yes,
here. Rachel.
At the risk of being very innocent, since I haven't read the book, I was interested, and very innocent, so you can almost rule it out of line. I was interested in when you, what I would call, switched gears or montaged into the triangulation of the female figure, Venice as the female figure, and then the homosocial relations among both actual people, you know, like actual writers mediated through Venice, and then also the reading of the James that way. That as one piece, sort of in relationship to the poetics that you were enunciating around doing the decor, doing lyricism, and all the associations with femininity that entails, in part because it strikes me as the gender strand moving through the analyses that wasn't foregrounded as much in this presentation only. But the other thing, my own personal comment on that, is how much more difficult it is for females, actual living females in the world, historical people, to do the decor than it is for male figures for whom it is an addition to their landscape rather than something that could be seen as a reversion in a female landscape. So my question is basically only how do, and then of course Marinetti and his crazy, anti-museum, anti-female, quote unquote, if you can read it that way, depends on how you read it, screed. Women are responsible, and so on. So I wonder whether you could just track for me a little bit, a few of the gender themes going through this book in relationship to the question.
Yeah, so it's a very good question, and there's a lot to say, and the gender argument sometimes gets, you know, buried within an argument about history and just the female signifying the past in general. But one phenomenon that I dwell on at some length in the book is the fact that in 1944, Marinetti envisioned the reconstruction of Venice in the form of a female colossus that was inhabitable, a female colossus of glass. And I'm actually translating this. It was his last major work, 1944, War-Torn Venice. He's living in Venice after having been battered at the front in Russia. And he's imagining basically this futurist paradise, and it's a massive, colossal statue with whose skirt is like 27 St. Mark's basilicas, and the breast plate is like 20 of the ducal palace, and then there's a bonnet that's made out of the Cadoro. So he takes all of the sort of anachronistic buildings in Venice and he places them into one composition. And he's trying to incorporate all this stuff from Africa into the composition as well, but he's trying to make amends with that notorious statement about hatred of women, rejection of woman, scorn for woman is the term that he uses. So there are all these kinds of recursions in all of the work to that which was rejected, and that's part of what I'm trying to track. And I also track, at the very end of the book, I talk about the New York School, and how for the New York School of poets, it wasn't necessary to reject cliched places like Venice, and it wasn't necessary to create a masculinist lineage of authors, but you could be kind of writing to one another. Duncan writes the Venice poem in the wake of Pound, and he's never been to Venice, but he's imagining Venice through the campanile on UC Berkeley's campus, which I find is so cute. and it has like that power. But so there are all these different lineages.
You could also ask the question in relationship to a homosexual Venice, which of course Duncan's poem is not about women, exactly. And Death in Venice, same yes. kind of story. But are you sure that Marinetti was making amends? No, I mean, you know it better than I do. Scorn for women, by the way, can be read as scorn for that which woman represents. And
yes,
some feminists could very well feel scorn for women as not
sure.
so much as for their sex, for their gender, but rather as scorn for the idea of woman that has been sort of dumped on women. And there is that way of reading Marinetti
exactly.
as a kind of radical break with ideas about womanhood that, it's a very damaging remark, a very dangerous remark, but are you sure he's really making amends by appropriating all of these? Yeah, never mind. Answer.
Well, yeah, I haven't decided, but I find it absolutely fascinating as a text that this was his solution for, recreating Italy, basically, because it's a kind of nationalist vision as well. And I do read Marinetti's remark as a radical rejection of the image of woman, and I actually think Marinetti is really fascinating, and not, I don't like to read him in that simplistic way.
Yes, Chris.
Hi, thank you. This is really fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book. I've been teaching in Venice in summer school for the last few years, and also before that, twice taught a seminar in the Venice Biennale and brought students, so this has become part of something I'm also trying to think through. And what strikes me is that, at least for contemporary artists who are showing at the Biennale, even though Venice, everything you say about it absorbing modernisms and not being conquerable by any one paradigm, is so complex, both environmentally, historically, in every way, that artists seem to be endlessly able to find new variations and to comment on Venice in the process of making a very contemporary project. And it takes so many forms that it's astonishing to me, but it's not a boring place to work in. It's not the white box. You have all kinds of historical situations that you can engage, or the geography of the place, or the whole idea of water and networks, travel, movement, layering. And so in a way, I feel that now it's become this very generative place. And even the national pavilions, which are often derided as an old idea, artists play with that.
Mm-hmm.
They exchange pavilions. They don't invite artists from their own country to represent them. fake pavilions sprang up. People try to, you know, there's all kinds of things that happen because of that structure that's also interesting. So I just wonder if you think that today it's actually inviting a different kind of avant-garde. Or, you know, I don't know if we can use that word, but a kind of artistic practice that's responding to this complexity.
Yes, I mean, I think in now when we're in an epoch in which installation and context are of great interest, yes, you have so many live spaces of history that can be reanimated. I mean, sadly, because they're uninhabited, because people cannot afford to keep them up because it's so expensive to be that unconnected to the mainland. But there were so many contemporary projects that I wanted to write about, and many, many of them fell away. I'd written about Rachel White Reed, I'd written about Jenny Holzer, I'd written about Bill Viola. I mean, so many. And I was only restricting myself to those that I thought actually said something significant, had engaged with the city in a significant way. And all of that had to get cut out because my book was way too long. It's already pretty long, having cut something like 40,000 words out of it. Yes, and I just didn't know how to stop. In fact, when I was in galleys, I learned about Carolee Schneeman's Venice work, which she ultimately did in St. Mark's, which is funny, St. Mark's Church. It just kept, there kept being more that had occurred there, and I had to just shut my ears at a certain point and accept that it doesn't have to be the end all and be all of my engagement with this place. But I do insist that it's generative, and I've had many people complain to me that I was interested in Venice, telling me that it's, just a museum and there's nothing new about it, blah, blah, blah. And yeah.
I wanted to maybe follow up on that. I was struck by the phrase light of the present that you used. Toward the conclusion, you're saying Venice is a series of objects, fragmentary, that we have to be seen through the light of the present. And you're talking about the boringness or the museum-like quality of Venice. But I found myself so shocked by the Google Maps image. And in many ways, like, it was more surprising than anything else because of the it's so green and blue and luscious, and there's the little farms. And
right. Those are NASA color enhancements so that you can see better what's happening. But
So I wanted to sort of ask about that. I see that light of the present as a sort of commentary both on your method in constructing it and an argument about Venice in a certain way. But I wonder if, in response to this like long history, and the avant-garde and modernism, if there's a certain way in which the light of the present now, or like these sort of like satellite images, how they play into your study, or if there's something about the space of Venice that's changed by, I imagine there's a really good Google Maps virtual tour that you can walk down the streets with your browser. I wonder how that might intersect with this, you know, long study that you've done.
Right. Well, I've been fascinated by the history of mapping, and Venice is a key site for the history of making maps. And, you know, before there was Google Images, there was this amazing, you know, bird's eye photographic view of Venice. It was a really big deal, and it was really expensive, and I felt really badly for them when Google Maps came along and, you know, made all of it obsolete. But, I mean, I'm fascinated in just the bird's eye view now and the history of that, how it's used in surveillance technology, how it has been used militarily. Venice was actually the site of the first air bombing, and that is because it was impossible to infiltrate for the Austrians, so they dropped bombs from balloons to stop the 1848 revolution, to shut down the Venetian Republic of 1848 that had been achieved. So I guess I actually haven't done GPS in Venice because once it's totally mapped, I'm going to be really depressed. because I actually still manage to get lost there, and I'm very attached to the fact that it still eludes that technology to some degree, and also my own powers of orientation, which have gotten much better over the course of this project. But I'm also just interested in seeing the city in that way systemically, seeing it as part of a world system, seeing it as part of, Lefebvre calls it, the production of space, and Lefebvre sees Venice as being paradigmatic of the production of space, of the dialectic between the work of art and pervasive forces of production, because it's connected to the sea. And these writers in the 70s, Calvino included, and Lefebvre, were fascinated by the fact that Venice's waters kind of make the network literal, like it's a watery network, and it's pierced on all sides by that globality, you know, and they're writing about that. So I've thought about that quite a lot, how this sort of medieval place somehow demonstrates to us better than other cities how everything is kind of connected, and the environmental crisis is made much clearer there than it is elsewhere.
You're offering a certain, not learning from Las Vegas, but learning from Venice as a guide to architecture. I saw a question.
That was so wonderful, thank you. And I wanted to ask about, there seems to be a contradiction, I was wondering if you could talk more about it, in terms of the Venice as kind of having an absorptive quality and amassing the sediment of so many artists that have interacted with it, but simultaneously being hollow in a certain way, of having the possibility to take on, I guess, whatever is projected upon it. And I'm thinking about in the Aspirin papers too, there seems to be a sort of revolution around the city, in which, and maybe to do also with getting lost and with it being simultaneously pierced by water, but also so substantive, and also substantive with chemicals. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about the, about kind of substance versus whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just, when you say that, there was actually Besualdo had read the Bruce Nauman installation as the thing, it had, Bruce Nauman did an installation there a few years ago, and there were three installations, and this artist, who's a fantastic writer, called the installations The Fingers to the City's Holes. And I just thought that ended up only in a footnote, you know, because my text was too long again. But it was an amazing thing to, an amazing way of thinking about it. So, I mean, yes, the dialectic of like presence and absence kind of, mass, like the too muchness of the architecture, all the encrustation of so much stuff in a confined space, but also the void of the sea, or at least what we perceive as a void, of course, and of the channels. I don't know, I mean, all I can really say is that it's something that you almost have to think about in the most material terms possible, and I kind of think about that in the Pound chapter as the relationship between water and stone, and how it's not as black and white as we think of it as being, because the water actually erodes the stone, but the stone gets built up by the water, forming stalagmites and stalactites. So it's just this place. I try to think about Pound's cantos as this play of presence and absence, and his thinking about water and stone in that way. It's something that's just there all the time. Whistler's etchings are amazing because some of them are almost blank. He has this one etching that's just Little Venice, and it's basically just one line. And they were really radical pieces for etchings in their time. I think they really redefined what etching was, and it has to do with the fact that sometimes looking out in Venice, that's all you see is like one line because of the thickness of the atmosphere there.
I wanted to thank all three of you. This has been a terrific evening. Charles was asking you, Jennifer, a little bit ago about the box of the National Literary Department, and I wanted to ask about period, literary periodization, which is in some ways the box we're even fonder of, right? Now we see jobs that are international or transnational or, you know, global Anglophone, but it's still post-45 or 20th century. And in some ways, you know, nobody loves period more than modernist studies folks, right? Whether it's 1890 or December 1910 or the Men of 1914 or the Annus Mirabilis 1922. And yet, you've described this project as polytemporal, and it seems to me that one of the attractions of Venice, maybe, or one of the things you've discovered about it as you worked on the project, was that it resists a certain logic of punctuality. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you to reflect a little bit on what this project has ended up meaning for you in terms of that kind of master category of the temporal or historical period, whether you feel that it still has work it can do for us, whether it has become mostly an impediment, and what it has meant to undertake a polytemporal project.
Yeah, I think it's mostly an impediment. I totally understand why it's there, because we can't read everything from everywhere that was ever written. But one of the beauties of writing about Venice meant that I could basically follow these lineages, these genealogies of writings, and that there was a really good excuse to talk about Shakespeare and Byron and Otway all at the same time. And Pound and Duncan, I mean, they're all borrowing each other's language. So, of course, because I'm living now and trying to write, I'm interested in unoriginality, in citationality, and, you know, where sources are coming from and how they're assembled and, you know, when that works. So my sense of temporality was also governed by that, like an art world that's interested in, you know, trying to figure out the question of authenticity, of originality, how citation is deployed. So Venice always seemed very contemporary to me. From my particular point of view, it was much more contemporary than a place that was just all of one time, like Brasilia or something. You know, the first city made to be seen from the air.
Although you are doing stuff on Brazil.
But although I'm fascinated with Brasilia and with Brazil, so I think I don't know what the answer is for getting out of our historical provincialism, you know, except that if you go to certain topics, you just can't get away from it. And in Italian scholarship, I mean, Italian scholarship is really bogged down by this because there's just this philological impulse and everything has to be placed in this long, imperious, patriarchal history. But at the same time, it's made for a lot of fascinating writings on history that are not really known here. And although I'm happy that Agamben is read, you know, I think we have a lot to learn from other national, you know, literary heritages that think much more about the dialogue between present and past and aren't so presentist.
I was looking for a good an adjective that could define how you work with Venice, and there's not one, but I was thinking of Beniamin saying of Naples that it was porous. Is there something like a term that would function? Mm-hmm. Because I have to add that I think your method is, to answer more or less to Charles' question, is very similar to that of Beniamin working on Paris.
Well, constellation,
yeah, a
is
constellation.
Another word. And palimpsest, of course, is the, in a way, an term that you're working on specifically in this with the literary stuff, because you're literally overwriting, in answer to Paul's question, part of the way you resolve it within our current academic environment is through this palimpsestic approach to the actual prose writing. So that one thing is literally layered on top of the other, so it doesn't really feel as much like montage as overlay or constellation. Mm-hmm. Although I think it fundamentally it's montage, as you say.
I began realizing that to write about Venice is always to do a kind of writing through. And so it's like that, you know? I mean, it's a palimpsest is a piece of paper, so if there were something about that it's more erodible, you know, I mean, I really do think of basically Ruskin is trying to see what's written in the water. And, you know, Keats's gravestone, here lies one whose name was writ on water. That kind of captures the drama of it, but I don't know that I, you know, I think that my colleagues saw me as writing on water, you know, but to me there were these blocks, you know, that there were these blocks as the ones that James talks about in the preface to The Wings of the Dove. He actually describes the novel as having these masses. They're like masses in relation. It's almost a kind of pre-vorticist figure. And he says that there aren't enough supports for the bridges, but they work anyway. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of that, you know, I mean, it's an archipelagic composition of various moments. Some chapters are more like this than the others. The fifth chapter is kind of archipelagic. So there are all these different moments, but they're all related to one another. It's a number of different authors and artists who are thinking through one another: Italo Calvino, Jeanette Winterson, Robert Coover, and their relationship to the urbanism of the time, and trying to constantly show how they're in dialogue with one another. But one of my colleagues said something like, we need to get out of the echo chamber. Because everything always refers back to another thing that was said by that person who was referring back to. So it's like this constant recursivity that's a bit of a nightmare to constantly sketch for the reader. So I had to choose when I would point it out and when I would just allude to it.
So thank you again to Jennifer and Charles.